is the Grinnion Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grinnion Report with your host, Mike Evans.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Grinnion Bunker, my friends, you know what time it is. Welcome to another week of weirdness. And I, of course, my friends, am the mouth of the South himself, Mr. Micah Hanks. It is none other than the Grinnion Report. Glad to have you with us for another adventure, another foray into Fortiana, as we so often like to do here on this program. Sitting across from me, the producer, the co-host of the program, the milkman himself, Mr. Chris Hayes. How are you?
I'm not the milk, and the milk's not me.
Who are you?
I'm Mickey.
Mickey, well, schizophrenia is a running rampant problem in America today, unfortunately. It appears to be running with you also. By the way, is your refrigerator running, Mr. Matthew Oakley?
Yes.
Well, you better go catch
it. Oh, my God.
Classic. Classic.
It's so good.
Our engineer, yes, working the master console here at Grinnion International. And then there's me, of course, the mouth of the South, Mr. Micah Hanks. I'll tell you, when you drink too much coffee like I do, it tends to alter, to a certain degree, your hearing, your ability to hear things properly. That or just the altitude down here, hundreds and hundreds of miles beneath terra firma. People still, to this day, you know, ask me if I broadcast live, if I really broadcast from a bunker underground. We have a hard time knowing if you're kidding or not. That's the thing that people always tell me. They're like, you know, hey, guess what? Just push the button, Chris. Thank you. People want to know if we're actually underground. I love how the milkman over here is sitting there.
Shh, turn my microphone off, Matt.
Oh, Lord. He's like, I'm trying to be discreet here. Chris, what is your thing tonight, man? You are just...
Discretion's never been your game anyways.
Yeah, so. What's going on over here, guy?
Well,
He's red in the face. His hair's all messed up.
I've had a life-changing experience in the last 20 minutes.
Guys. Well, have you? Well, yes. Tell us about this. I want to hear about this.
I can't. It's deeply personal.
Deeply personal.
Absolutely.
He can't share his life with us. Well, I'll tell you one thing I can share with you. Hot off the press, literally within just the last 2.5 hours, the AP reports, mysterious crop circles have appeared in an eastern Washington wheat field. This is true. Not far from the nation's largest hydropower producer. But area farmers preparing for the summer's harvest find the distraction more amusing than alarming. They say you can't do anything other than laugh about it, these circles appearing in this field. This is according to Cindy Gieb, who owns the field along with her husband, Greg. You just kind of roll with the theory it's aliens. Oh, yeah. We don't know. Therefore, what? Aliens! That's right. I mean, come on, that's logic,
just
right?
So long as you have conclusive proof, I don't see what the...
We have conclusive proof of nothing except for the fact that we know that a negative plus a negative obviously equals a positive. Therefore, we will justify an unknown quantity with another unknown quantity.
Oh, yeah, aliens.
We don't know. Therefore, aliens. And so they, too, Cindy and Greg here, out in Washington State, say that they are rolling with the typical theory. It's aliens, and you're special because aliens chose your wheat field for their, well, spot. The aliens have marked their territory yet again. Friends called the Gibbs on July 24th when the pattern of flattened wheat was spotted off Highway 174 about 5 miles north of the town of Wilbur. The field is about 10 miles south of the Grand Coulee Dam, which the Bureau of Reclamation claims is the largest hydropower producer in the United States. Now, the circles resemble a four-leaf clover in shape and remind Cindy of, well, Mickey Mouse ears. The design knocked down about an acre of their wheat. Some of it could be salvaged by combines when the harvest starts in a week or two, she said, but some, indeed, no matter what they try and do, will be lost. Of course, we don't have an or any kind of alien insurance, she said. Alien insurance, imagine that! You know, I don't know what the explanation behind these crop circles is or is not. You know, there are many people who get out there and say that they're the ones that are doing these things, that they're making these things in fields with groups of people, you know, armed with little devices and apparatus that allow them to push down the wheat fields, or the wheat in the fields, rather, in these formations. There are some that claim that this is some sort of a natural phenomena of some sort. I mean, there are many out there, actually. People who are of, certain repute and people who are fairly well known in various circles, you know, for not jumping to odd conclusions, who say, yeah, whatever causes these crop circles, it probably isn't, you know, some sort of a human-made phenomenon. This is actually probably some sort of a natural phenomenon. So who knows what actually is behind some of these? I know that some of them are so large that there remains debate over how they could be produced in such a short amount of time. Presumably, you know, roughly a 8 to 12-hour period sometime overnight. But these are surely out there, and they've appeared only today. Of course, the farmers aren't incredibly concerned about this. The latest series of circle formations was first reported Tuesday by Spokane station KHQ-TV. There were no signs that anyone walked into the field to make these. We're trying to figure out how they got out there without breaking any of the wheat. It's hard to walk through the crunchy wheat and not knock it down, according to Gieb, who, as we had said previously, said that they were buying the alien theory. Obviously, they aren't. At the same time, it's hard to think it's aliens. It's a bizarre thing to try and wrap your brain around. Gieb's daughter-in-law, Kelly Gieb, this is G-E-I-B. Boy, I hope I'm pronouncing their last name wrong, how many times I've called them the Gieb's. Of Wilbur. The Gieb family of Wilbur.
It's my new favorite music group.
Matt, quit being a Gieb. Have you heard this great new band, the Gieb's? Anyway, the Gieb's of Wilbur say that the crop circle has given the family something to ponder and something to chuckle about. The kids all like to say that the aliens have come, and well, for the time being at least, we are happy to indulge them. Well, I think as a society, we're fairly overindulgent these days as it stands already with regard to our acceptance of the alien, the extraterrestrial meme. But as I often say, I digress, and so as not to ponder too long what may or may not be the crux of the issue, we'll move right along. Have you heard that there are hundreds of millions right now without power in India? This is true. Hundreds of millions of people have literally been left without electricity in northern and eastern India after a massive power breakdown. This one comes to us via BBC News, courtesy of our friend Red Pill Junkie of DailyGrail.com. More than half the country was hit by the power cuts after three grids collapsed, one for a second day now. Hundreds of trains have come to a standstill and hospitals are running on backup generators. The country's power minister has blamed the crisis on states drawing too much power from the national grid. The breakdowns in the northern, eastern, and northeastern grids mean around 600 million people have been affected in 20 of India's states. You know what happens, of course, if they are, you know, left without power for too long, of course. You know, food starts to spoil, depending on whether or not, you know, they're able to access water via electrical pumps and things like that, or even gasoline and these sorts of things. Yes, it could get quite dire. We'll hope that they get things worked out over there in northeastern India where this circumstance is taking place right now. Power Minister Kumar Shinde said that he had appealed to states to try and stop trying to take more than their quota of power. Try and cut back, he says. I've also instructed my officials to penalize the states which overdraw from the grid, he said in a public statement. You know, I tell you, the power issue, yes, indeed, that is something that is concerning to so many. I was talking with a producer of the popular television program Conspiracy Theory yesterday, and they were talking about the production of something we've talked about a lot on this program, Petri Meat. And he had said that one theory about the use of something along the lines of Petri meat. When I say Petri meat, what we're talking about is bioengineered or genetically engineered meat substitutes created in laboratories. Hence, we call them Petri meat here on this program. And he had said, you know, one theory right now is that when the New World Order takes over, they're trying to create a renewable food source for, you know, militant armies or even possibly armies of who knows what or who may be involved in such a takeover. And I said, well, you know, but the other thing, too, is that, you know, in very realistic terms, we're facing potential shortages, you know, and also potential overpopulation and concerns associated with overpopulation in the coming years. And so that may be a different angle to take as well. But just as well as resources, of course, you know, power consumption, which is a resource in itself, these sorts of things come into question just as well and become considerations. So who knows where this is actually going to go. That's the news for right now. I tell you, we're going to be later in this program not only talking about a UFO that was allegedly seen over the Olympic opening ceremonies. Have you heard about this one? Yes, some people say that a flying saucer made its appearance over the opening ceremonies in London for the Olympics this week. We're also going to be talking about the secret shadow government and then a discussion with Kenneth Thomas about conspiracies, UFOs, JFK, and much more during Hour 2. And last week, as a quick update, an addendum, I guess, if you will, since last week we talked about Westboro Baptist on the program last week. They're this group of rather militant individuals associated with a church out. Chris, where are they located? Where is Westboro again?
I have no idea.
Okay, well, that's our Handy, the milkman producer. They're in
a place called Westboro. I don't really care what state they're in because they're not in my state.
Okay, well, they're out west. But the thing is that apparently they were attacked by zombies. Very funny. We were just talking about them on the show last week. And now news breaks that a Westboro Baptist Church protest was earlier this week overshadowed when demonstrators dressed as zombies gathered at a DuPont, Washington military base to counter the radical group's efforts after members of the controversial Kansas-based church announced plans to picket Joint Base Lewis-McChord, a military base south of Seattle. Then 27-year-old Melissa Neese decided to organize a counter-protest in which she said launching a Facebook group titled Zombieing Westboro Baptist Church Away from Fort Lewis was absolutely necessary, and they did.
Well, you just said it, although I don't think you realize you said it, but Westboro Baptist Church, I'm like Porky Pig over here, they hail from Topeka, Kansas.
Topeka, Kansas.
So just keep that in mind. Never go there.
Listen to the guy. Well, I thought it was interesting. We were talking about him just last week on the program, and then maybe some listeners of this program, I don't know, heard that and decided to take action in the form of zombies. Who knows? Which sparked a bit of a religious debate. You know, our resident theologian, Mr. Chris Hayes, who is, you know, I would say probably most effectively put, you are an agnostic, if anything, Chris. He raises an eyebrow at me. I think you, if anything, are an agnostic. This guy one day of the week may say he doesn't believe anything, and then he'll turn right around, and of course he's down on his knees praying for Matt and I and the sins that we commit, which we thank you for. Mr. Chris, but you know, we got some listener email this week. Matt writes, this is in regard to Chris's statement toward the end of your July 24th episode. And by the way, love the show. Chris is 99% correct. Westboro Baptist is, in fact, living the truest biblical life, according to Matt, who actually, later in this email, which I've read previously, states that he is a former Baptist minister himself. He says, Westboro Baptist is, in fact, living the truest biblical life. All they need to do now is begin stoning homosexuals and disobedient children, he says. Now, of course, he's speaking tongue-in-cheek here and pointing out some of the things that Westboro Baptists are known for being politically active toward. Some of these things that make them culturally and socially detestable, of course. For 10 years, Matt says, I was an egotistical, albeit miserable, Baptist preacher. Technically, I'm still an ordained minister in the church, which ordained me, which has yet also to revoke my ministerial, I guess, what would you call it, a license. He says, now I'm an egotistical, happy atheist. During my time in Christianity, I was often ostracized and ridiculed for my libertarian leanings. In 1995, I quit voting Republican because I became a libertarian and was shocked by the outcry by my fellow preachers over such a menial thing. He says, I have also since taken on the philosophy of anarchism. There were also issues that I felt no vice should be illegal, drug use, gambling, such and such. I was also known for not believing everything a preacher said from behind the pulpit. He said, I always had difficulty with the fact that the good book that I pledged my life to supported such things as slavery, genocide, government, death penalty, subjugation of women. Those were things I would simply avoid talking about during my own time. He said, I think it was my decision to use reason and logic to face those topics instead of blind faith that led me out of Christianity. This was his, of course, path, which he's discussing here. He says, my only disagreement with Chris, however, is when he attempted to distinguish between Christian and Christ-like. In my opinion, Matt says, there actually is no difference. They are one and the same. Love the show, though personally, I think Chris should do much more speaking than he does, and really, I wouldn't mind him hosting his own show. Take care and keep up the good work. Matt Evans from Fort Wayne. Boy, I don't know about that. I may have to disagree with Matt about Chris having his own show.
I think everybody in America does.
The last thing that we need to do is we need to contribute to the detriment of our society by giving this man more time on the microphone.
I'm pretty sure it would have the exact absolute effect, absolute opposite effect of what you just said.
Oh, yeah? What was the effect that I said it would have?
You said that it would be a detriment to the country.
I can't even hear you. You don't even talk. Jeff, would you get him to turn his microphone up, please?
Is that better?
Yeah, I think so. I think
so. Do you like that?
I can hear you a little bit better. I think Chris is having a hard time talking tonight. You know, until Chris learns how to talk and speak up a little bit, I don't think we're going to give him his own show. But for the time being, you'll have to continue to put him up. That's all, folks. You have to put up with him on this one. You go, boy. When we come back, you know, I tell you, I do like getting to listener emails. So we're going to try and touch on a few more. Because, well, we seldom really get to offer the insights of our listeners on this program. So we're going to take a little time to do that and then get to some news afterward here on this edition of the Graylian Report. Stay tuned. Hi, this is Micah Hanks of the Graylian Report. Have you heard about the Paradigm Symposium 2012 yet? Well, it's going to be a huge event we're putting on along with Intrepid Magazine up in Minneapolis, Minnesota this October 18th through 21st. But rather than just having me tell you about it, here's George Norrie from Coast to Coast AM. George?
Thanks, Micah. This is George Norrie of Coast to Coast AM inviting you to attend the Paradigm Symposium 2012. If you love UFOs and aliens, lost civilizations, and mysteries of the past, well, this is the event for you. And all you have to do to learn more is visit ParadigmSymposium.com.
The Paradigm Symposium 2012, reviewing our past and changing our future. Check us out online, ParadigmSymposium.com. That website again, ParadigmSymposium.com. Broadcasting from the Night Kitchen. Welcome, my friends. It is the Graylian Report, your weekly hub for the strange and the unusual. I'm Micah Hanks, joined in studio, as always, by engineer Matt Oakley and, well, the guy whose name is not Mickey, Mr. Chris Hayes, our producer.
Whispering Chris.
Oh, Whispering Chris Hayes is on the microphone.
Hey, you guys, I don't whisper. I cut that out.
Here he comes, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to turn it over to you. Good night. And now, Mr. Whispering Chris Hayes. He's whispering, apparently.
That's my whisper. Sorry, guys.
Apparently, that was your whisper. Fortunately, our listeners have been speaking up. If you'd like to contact us here at the program, you can reach us info@graylianreport.com. I don't read listener emails often enough on this show, and therefore tonight I'm going to dedicate a little time, while we have it, to reading listener emails. Mario writes, "Dear Graylians, I just wanted to know who or what artist plays the bumper music that starts your podcast program. It's some guitar riffs at the beginning of the show, and then it fades into, a voicer, and then Micah begins his intro. Any info is appreciated. Keep up the great job."
Did he just say, "Dare Graylians"? Does he think we're German?
No, he says, "Dear Graylians."
Okay. I thought you were like, "Dear Graylians."
And Mario, actually, I believe, is an Italian name, Chris.
Oh, well, I mean, I'm sure there are Italians in Germany.
Well, to answer Mario's question, that's one of the wonderful things about this podcast is that the music that you hear on this program, 99% of the time, well, okay, maybe not 99, we'll say 90% of the time, the music you hear on this show is produced in-house by us. We actually have a production facility here, and then we've got Matt over there who's hiccuping into his microphone, and of course, Chris the Milkman Hayes here. We all work very hard at doing what we do on this program, and we manage also in the midst of all the production of programming and gathering news stories and getting guests lined up and doing what we do for you on a weekly basis, we actually try our best to produce spots and programs, or rather music, in-house here for you as well. The theme music that you hear on this show each week that starts off each hour of the program is actually a tune that was, get this, written and composed and performed by yours truly, Micah Hanks. Because I happen to be a guitarist, I perform on the weekends as a musician. That's a great way to make income in the summertime, and if you're in the wintertime, well, you might as well get another pickup gig pumping gas, right?
Could you hum a little bit of it so we know which one you're talking about? I could play it, but I'd prefer you hum it.
How's it go? Let's see. 2, 3. Yeah, that one.
I would like everyone to know the milkman did not back this up.
Matt was backing me up there, yeah. Well, that's actually a Micah Hanks original. a lot of the music that we feature on this program. I've always referred to him as DJ Transhuman, Caleb Hanks, but he actually says his official stage name is The Clerk. And you can check out Caleb Hanks. Actually, just Google the name Caleb Hanks. Caleb produces a lot of our music. We also feature the music of Christopher Blake Germain. We featured some of the music of Mac Maloney, the group Rat Jackson, and a few others. And, of course, if you have music that you would like to send along to be featured on the program, you can always reach us, again, info@graylianport.com. You could also reach Chris and Matt. Chris is a producer at graylianport.com. Matt Oakley is engineer at graylianport.com to reach these gentlemen. Matt Oakley actually handles a lot of the music, and so if you'd like to send some music along to Matt Oakley, that's engineer at graylianport.com. I'm sure he would be appreciative of anything you'd like to send along.
And because I'm sure this nickname that Mike has been giving me, the Milkman, is going to stick, I'm going to go ahead and make Milkman at graylianreport.com. So if you have any dairy-related questions, you can go ahead and send your email to that one, and I'll be sure to get back to you.
Homogenized in the Moho.
What about the Whispering Chris email?
No, Whispering Chris sounds like a pedophile, so let's not make that one happen.
Here comes old Whispering Chris. Whispering Chris Hayes.
Hey, I got something for you in my pocket.
You like popsicles? Why don't you go down the cellar and get you one?
Oh, gosh, I'll tell you. You know, we're deep enough down underground right now. Don't want to go into the cellar. It's not obscene. That's just not where we go when we do this program. Joe writes, with all the talk about green fireballs on your show, he says, now I have to include my stories of the strange for you and your listeners. I first want to say that I'm a skeptic. Well, so are we, Joe. You're in good company. He says, I don't believe in any of the paranormal accounts, abduction cases, or cryptozoological encounters, but that does not mean I'm not curious about them or that I don't believe that they could not happen. I just need the factual, undisputed, empirical evidence that never seems to be present. Boy, that just seems to be the bane of our existence. But it interests us enough to continue searching just as well. So Joe says, I have about as many strange, unexplained experiences as most of the people that you guys talk about, which is probably why I have such a profound interest in the subject. My first incident was back in around 1979. I was about 5 or 6 years old. We lived in the backwoods of Wasilla, Alaska. Wait, wasn't Sarah Palin, isn't she from Wasilla? Didn't she live there?
Do you know if you can see Russia from there?
You might be able to see Russia from her back porch, maybe.
Well, then she's got far more foreign policy experience than Barack Obama.
Well, I don't think we need to make that comparison tonight.
Oh, come on. That was like 3 years ago. Barack Obama has at least a little bit more foreign policy experience.
I don't know. I'm so glad. When he says things like that, it's when I'm glad I live down here in a cave underground.
I was giving credit to our commander-in-chief.
Yeah,
it's when you say things like that I'm glad I live in a cave underground. Sorry. Anyway.
And we just cringe every time still. You know? It doesn't matter.
I tell you, I'm so okay, I'm sorry. We were reading Joe's email. We won't talk about my disenfranchisement with American politics right now.
Or Chris.
Or my disenfranchisement with the Milkman. He's wearing a white shirt, okay? Here we are, you know, you and I are wearing team colors, and he shows up in a white V-neck T-shirt. I'm sorry, you're the Milkman from now on.
It's because I'm the Milkman. You know what? That sounds kind of groovy. You know what? From now on, I'm the Milkman.
The Milkman, Chris Hayes, the guy with the lightest skin of any, lighter than any Hadel, in fact.
Chris the Milkman Hayes.
Well, we all have to have some sort of a calling in life. Anyway, Joe lived in the backwoods of Wasilla, Alaska, and he said that where we live was about a half an hour drive from the other side of the valley, and that there was a clear view of the mountainside from where we were. He said, I recall quite clearly my stepdad pulling over on the side of the road to look at something on the mountain. It was an odd thing to do, since there was not any wildlife on our way. Moose or bear might occasionally decide to use the roads, but it wasn't that common, and people would have to pull over and wait for them to move on if they did indeed tend to show up. But this time there wasn't anything there in the road. He said, we were staring off into the distance. I was trying to find out what Dad was looking at. It was a clear afternoon and the sun was out, and he said, before long I realized we were staring at a long cigar-shaped object. Now I say cigar-shaped, but it was more squared off, really, than tube-shaped. It was huge. Not that I could judge the length of it then, but my memory is clear of it enough that I now estimate it was maybe a mile long. Wow, that's really large. So he sees this mile-long thing hovering up there. He said it was moving slowly south to north along the mountain. It was below the crest of the mountain, maybe 500 feet above the base. It was brownish in color with two very distinct black rectangular things on the underside, one in the front and one in the rear. From our position across the valley, we were almost dead even with it, almost above it. I would say that we were maybe 5 or 6 miles away from this object. We watched it quietly and smoothly glide along the mountain until it passed beyond our vision. From the moment we first saw it until it was gone, it took about 20 minutes or so. My stepdad and I didn't really talk about it. But I asked him what it was that we saw, and he said he didn't know. And to be honest, I think it freaked him out because he never talked about it ever again and really preferred to change the subject after the fact when I did ask about it. Well, moving on to the present day, my second experience with unknown aerial phenomenon was in Auburn, Washington in 1994. It was late around midnight, and my then-girlfriend and I were arguing outside my townhome, which overlooked Auburn Valley. And to the west was what my friends and I called Pig Hill, due to a Piggly Wiggly grocery store that was on it. Well, in the middle of the valley was the Auburn Airport, and so during our lover's quarrel, we were interrupted by an object that was spherical and about twice the size of a Volkswagen Beetle, brightly glowing electric neon green. It was not very high in the sky, maybe a few hundred feet off the or above tree level. It moved from behind me and across the valley toward the airport. It was completely silent. It was moving very, very fast, much faster than the air traffic that I'm extremely accustomed to viewing from the airport nearby, since I do like to watch the planes land and take off from that location. As far as my own experiences go, I'm still skeptical about the origin of these objects, but the fact is, I saw them. That's it. Hope you found it interesting, and take care. That's Joe H., who tells those stories. You know, I'm always intrigued by stories of people's encounters with things seen in the skies. On last week's program, I told you about something that I saw with my own two eyes recently over Asheville, North Carolina, and I've had a lot of people writing about the potential for drones to be in the airspace. Matt Matan, a friend of mine who's a radio host here in Asheville, North Carolina, said, oh man, drones are all over the place. Now that the government has essentially given jurisdiction for this sort of thing and for the use of drones, you know, there are certain even drone type aircraft that civilians have access to. But this thing that I saw, unless it was, you know, some sort of a conventional aircraft and it was just coming in at an angle or something else was going on that caused it to look extremely unusual and appear to be moving extremely slowly, I couldn't really tell you what I saw. But I'll tell you this, the very next night, we were doing the program, in fact. It was Tuesday evening, we were finishing up the program, and my younger brother Caleb Hanks, who provides a lot of music for the show and occasionally comes on as a commentator on this program, sent me a text message. He was an outdoor showing of the film Ghostbusters at a movie theater here in the area, and he said, I'm sitting outside with a friend, and the damned drone is flying overhead right now. He says, whatever this thing is, it's got red and green lights, clearly triangle in shape. It flew directly over us, headed south along I-26, went down toward the Asheville Regional Airport, turned around, came back, and was moving far too slowly to be an airplane. I don't know what this thing is, but I've spoken to other people who claim to have seen it. One of our field correspondents, Tyler Pittman, was amazed when he heard our description because he, too, says that he saw the object not just over 26, but hovering in midair over I-26. What did it look like, Tyler? And Tyler told me that it was about the size of a fairly large automobile, triangle-shaped, and that it had red, green, and possibly blue lights, as well as one very large white light on this craft. So I'm very interested in the potential for there being, and again, you know, I'm kind of like Joe there, in that I don't know that I would necessarily prescribe to the notion that these aircraft are something otherworldly or unexplainable in conventional terrestrial terms. I think in all likelihood we're dealing with some sort of terrestrial phenomenon, but it's still interesting when you see something up there in the sky that you, well, you're not accustomed to seeing, and you don't have an explanation right off for it. What are these things? Are there really drones up there? That seems to be the most likely explanation, but if they weren't drones, well, what else could they be? It's an interesting question, if you ask me. We have another listener email here. This one's a bit longer. I wanted to get to this one from Chris. He says, I've never thought of myself as having experienced any UFO sightings myself until I started listening to shows like yours and Coast to Coast AM, and then I realized, well, maybe I had seen a few strange things over the years. When I lived in Sacramento, California as a child, for instance, my brother and I had a bedroom in the laundry room of the house. It was small, and the house faced out into an alleyway. Well, one night, it must have been hot as the door was open, and we both saw a glowing orb of orange about the size of a basketball just whiz down the alley through that open door. We moved from left to right, which would have been east to west. We never thought much about it. Just to make sure I wasn't seeing things, I asked him some 20, maybe 30 years later, if he remembered that incident from so many decades ago, and he said yes, he did. The orange ball reminded me of some of the photos of the orange sun that I've seen on the internet. Not a solid color, but kind of like, well, a close-up of the sun, licking flames and all. When I was in high school, also in Sacramento, but at a different location, I saw another orange ball, just like the first one, only it was traversing across the sky from north to south in an arc. I suppose following the curvature of the earth, you might say. It was probably about two-thirds the size of a full moon. I don't think these are anything like the orbs on Brown Mountain that you speak of often on the program. Now, skip to last year. I deliver newspapers to other carriers, and also I have a rote myself. Boy, I'm sorry. I'm sounding like I'm living on the Outer Banks there, whom I've been told have their very interesting, very secluded accent. Well, these guys in the studio, folks, I wish you could be in here seeing the studio from my eyes, because Chris and Matt are so involved in their work that they're not even listening to these emails I'm reading here. I'm having a good time just watching you guys. Matt, read the rest of this for me so I can just sit here and watch you guys. I want to watch you guys work for... I'm taking the night off, okay? Chris?
We'll have the whisper.
You basically take the night off every night, so I mean, it's not really a big deal.
Matt,
I'm over here working and listening to you because, yes, I can do two things at once, and you just sit in your little throne and you judge away, you judge,
I judge,
and then you unsilently judge.
I write, I read, I don't know. Matt, let's go easy on Chris. He's got an early shift delivering milk to the families in the neighborhood. He's going to get to
them. Whispering to their children.
Whispering into people's ears before they wake up.
You're just jealous. I see it for what it is now. You are jealous of my milkman powers.
Well, you know, Chris here, not this Chris. I'm sorry. I'm getting mixed up on my Chris's. Okay, Chris Hayes here in studio delivers milk in the mornings. Well, Chris, who wrote this email, delivers newspapers. And he said... and he has a route himself, as I tried to say a moment ago and tripped over my own tongue. He says, one night I was driving, I noticed a steady white blinking light in the sky in a place where there should not have been a blinking light of any kind. He said it was way too high to be a cell phone or other kind of tower, but that's kind of what it looked like. He said it just stayed in one place. It continued blinking for some time and then just, well, winked out. I soon forgot about it until I was driving further west and noticed the light was blinking yet again. As near as I could tell, it was approximately in the same place as the previous blinking light, and so I assumed, well, this must be the same one I'd seen earlier. It eventually winked out for good. Well, within 2 or 3 days, as I was driving, I noticed another steady, white blinking light in approximately the same place as before. It looked the same, and again, this is several shifts later on a different day of the week. There were no details that were observable at the time in either sightings, if that's what I can even call it. It eventually winked out, not lasting as long as the previous time. As I got to a certain place in the road, I noticed a very bright and steady blinking light about 5 miles away, I guessed. It turned out that it was about the distance away, as best I can tell, around 5 miles. But the light was by far brighter than anything else around in the sky or even on the ground. I mean, it was really bright, and it appeared to be really large, even at that 5 mile distance or so. The extreme brightness probably made it seem that way. It was like the brightness of a strobe light or whatever is on a cell phone tower. The light had never been there before, quite like this. This time this light was on the horizon. I didn't think of it when I got to the west end of my route. I just turned around and left the area, but the next night the really bright light was back. And this time when I reached the west end of my route, I turned south because I knew there was a hill there that I might be able to see whatever was causing the blinking light. Perhaps it would make a better vantage, and so I headed toward the hill, and what I saw was kind of a surprise and different from anything I'd ever seen before. Now, I'm not sure I can describe it. Let's take a cell phone tower, maybe the kind that are somewhat similar in shape to the Eiffel Tower in Paris, France. You know, just a big, tall, straight tower. Now, remember, it was pitch black at this time of the morning. There was no moon. Now, let's take the shape of that tower, maybe just a bit wider. It had a wide horizontal bar of light that started from the top of the tower and moved toward the bottom of the tower, expanding as it neared the bottom. It never actually reached the bottom, maybe two-thirds of the way down. When reaching its bottommost place, this is again on a light which I take to have been hovering in the sky, he says, the light immediately started at the top again and continued back down and would move like that, over and over and over again. I couldn't actually see any kind of a tower. The light defined the shape of whatever this thing was. It was really tall and about 3 or 4 football fields away. Well, to the left of this light show appeared a lesser light. I thought it might have been an external farm light or something. It was much dimmer, now that I think about it, than the usual farm light would. In fact, that's what I thought it was, just maybe a farm light, something like that, some sort of a conventional light source. Well, after this encounter, A little time went by, and then about 2 months later during the day, I was passing near this area, and I thought of that light, and I thought, I'll just go back up to where I saw those strange lights. Now that it's daytime, I'll surely be able to see if there's a tower there. What was even stranger was the fact that the only thing I could see was a string of high-tension power lines, much smaller than the pulsating light I'd seen. There was no farmhouse. In fact, the only thing within my vision were these power lines and grassy hills in the distance. There was nothing else in the air where those lights would have been. I didn't know what I was looking at. I call it my ULO, Unidentified Landed Object, because from that perspective, I took that maybe it was kind of close to the ground, even though there were no towers or anything there. I've since thought, in my imagination, that I was looking at some kind of a giant ship with the lesser light being maybe a window. However, there were no details that I could make out. So there you have it, for what it's worth. I was unable to identify anything, but there this thing was nonetheless. Any ideas? Maybe our listeners have seen something along those lines.
I actually can tell you exactly what it was. That small blinking light up in the distance, what that was is the... It may not have looked like it with the rest of the skyline, but Chris was actually out camping on a mountain one night, and he was trying to signal SOS with his flashlight, and nobody...
To the other milkmen?
Yeah, to the other milkmen, but nobody came.
Is this true? Can you corroborate this story, Chris?
I can neither confirm nor deny some of the more intimate details of the story.
I see. Well, that is pretty interesting that after returning to the spot, and I hear so many stories like that. People return to the location where they had been maybe the night or several nights before and see that there was something there in the dark that no longer existed in the daylight. And this was what happened with Chris. He said it looked like a large tower. Again, he couldn't see a tower, but it was as though the light were moving up and down this object and that the shape of whatever he'd seen was defined by the light. And returning in the daylight, he says there were a few power lines and rolling fields, but there was no sort of a tower or anything like that. So what had those lights been attached to? Nothing? Who knows what was going on? I tell you, one of my very favorites, and this will be our last listener email for this edition of the program, at least. And if you would like to contact us and share your own, when we have time and when we have... the ability. We like to get to listener emails from time to time. You can email us info@graylianreport.com. Some of these stories are just so good. I like to touch on these from time to time. I think everybody enjoys a good story. And when I was probably in my teens, was when I first became aware of the phenomenon known as shadow people. Now, this is something that really scares a lot of people. I know a while back on the program, we read a story where a person claimed to have had contact with what maybe they called a shadow person. And that they were lying in the top bunk of a bunk bed one night, and they looked over to their right and saw this dark, shrouded figure standing there that spoke to them and said, "I'm cold. Give me covers." You remember that? This person actually said that this thing almost reminded them of Mothman for some reason, because they said that the shrouds reminded him of big wings wrapped around this being, and that the being had said, "I'm cold. Give me covers." But of course, those who are intimately familiar with the mythos surrounding Mothman know about Indrid Cold, an alleged MIB that had been associated with the reports of the Mothman. And I thought it was interesting, of course, that we have the story of what someone claimed looked like a moth-like being or some sort of a winged being, but nonetheless something kind of ethereal standing by their bed, a little menacing even. And this thing says to them, "I'm cold, give me covers." It always sounded a lot like the sorts of reports we hear when we hear stories of these shadow people. And we do from time to time get stories of shadow people. Well, tonight we've got one that Jerry writes to share. He says, about 15 years ago when I had relocated to another area, he says, near Alberta, Canada. Boy, and by the way, from these emails, we had Sacramento, California. We've got Alberta, Canada. I don't recall where the story before that was located. I think the gentleman says Wasilla, Alaska. You can tell that our listenership is absolutely spread out all over the place. So it doesn't matter where you're from, what country, what part of the world you're from, we always enjoy hearing your stories. So Jerry had been in Alberta, Canada. He said, "I shared a house in my new town with three other people while I set up business and waited my family to follow. One night I went to bed there in the new home as usual and was preparing to fall asleep. And then a very strange feeling came upon me." He says, "As I laid flat on the bed, a sensation started at the soles of my feet, and is best described as a rumbling sort of vibration, rather like a loud noise might make if it were directed right at you." He says, "The sensation traveled up through my legs toward my torso. The pitch of the vibration remained at the very same rate. However, there was a slightly audible quality to it. As the sensation passed through my torso, a buzzing noise became more apparent. And then as it passed through my head, the noise became almost deafening, and a bright light, like a fluorescent tube passing through my skull, was picked up by my eyes, which, of course, were still shut at the time. Now, once the sensation passed beyond the top of my skull, it didn't reverse itself and travel back. I remember half-jokingly describing it as well being scanned by aliens. What else could you compare that to, you know? But it certainly does remind me of the grocery store scanner used with barcodes, except this was white light and not laser red. And my friends looked upon my description with a jaundiced eye. I think in my case, my friends would probably suggest that, well, I'd just been on drugs. But I hadn't been. And this was not the last of the paranormal events that took place in this house. In fact, a year later, all of the housemates left and my family relocated to the house. Now, my two youngest sons shared an upstairs bedroom, the room I used to have when I shared the house, which was across the hall from my wife's and my bedroom. Downstairs, our daughter and our oldest son had a room each, and this was a raised bungalow. We kept our bedroom door open, which allowed us to see from our bed into the open door of our younger boy's room. But one morning, I awoke to see our oldest son, Joel. He walked into his brother's room. Now, Joel was fully clothed, as if he were ready to go outside and go play. And he was going to go wake his brothers up and ask them to join him. But this was early in the morning, probably 4 or maybe even 5 o'clock. It was way too early to be waking anybody up, and so I called out in a hushed tone, "Joel, don't go in there, don't wake him." But he continued on into that room. I wasn't ready at that time to have three young boys awake and running around the house, and so I got out of bed. I went into my son's room. I was still complaining in hushed tones, "Shh, don't go in there, don't go, Joel, don't wake him up. It's way too early to be getting up." But when I got into the room, I found that the room was dark, quiet, and of course with the two younger boys still fast asleep. And what's more, there was no Joel in that room. I thought to myself, it didn't take that long to get in here, but there's no way Joel could have left the room without me seeing unless my back was maybe turned for a split second, so I decided to track Joel down at this point. I went downstairs to Joel's room. I opened the door, and there he was, still fast asleep and still in his pajamas. Whoever or whatever it was that I saw going into the boy's room resembled a young boy for sure, and maybe about Joel's age too, 9 or 10 years old, but whatever it was didn't belong there, and it certainly wasn't Joel. Of course, I shared the story with my family, and a few months later, my kids, unsupervised, borrowed a Ouija board from a friend. Oh, that's always a good idea, huh? And they decided they would try and find out who this child that I had seen may have been. Now, they say they came in contact with the spirit of a young boy who claimed to be named Richard and who had been killed by a car some years earlier. We live in a small town, and the neighborhood is only about 30 years old. We have no anecdotal evidence of any such incident happening in our area, at least a fatality or involving a child named Richard. Well, I tell you, that's the one way I probably wouldn't want to try and find that kind of information out, using a Ouija board. What, Chris?
No, just the thought of someone using a Ouija board, because, I mean, if you've been listening to our show over the past year and a bit, we did actually a top 5 list about Ouija boards, and one of them was an anecdotal story of a young boy who was playing with a Ouija board and decided to ask the Ouija when he was going to die.
Oh, God.
If the Ouija board knew when he was going to die.
Again, something I wouldn't ask a Ouija board.
I know, because in response to that, his head exploded.
Oh, that really happened, yeah.
That was a story we heard.
That's not true.
Yeah, I mean,
so he was actually playing with the Ouija board and his head exploded right then.
Yeah, because he asked the Ouija board, "When am I going to die?" And his head exploded.
I think it was like a really religious website where this guy was warning.
No, it was an overtly joking website, I think. Because there were things like, you know, if you see your kids playing with an online Ouija board, you need to take the computer away from them, scream at your kids, let them know they're going to hell, take the computer outside and run it over with your 4x4 truck.
Okay, well,
those were the instructions. I can't think that was, you know, serious.
Well, I hope not.
Unless everyone has a 4x4 truck.
Well, about the same token, I've heard a lot of horror stories associated with Ouija boards. Now, I think a lot of it stems from the mind, but who knows? You know, my mother had a very interesting experience, very similar to Jerry's children here, in which she claimed to have been in touch with a man named Ralph, who was maybe just in his late teens, and also claimed that he had been killed when a convertible that he was driving flipped off of a bridge and pinned him in a river when it toppled over. But there's more to Jerry's story, and I want to go ahead and get to that. I guess, actually, though, if we're gonna do this, we'll probably have to wait until we come back from the break. Again, it's a little longer story, but we're featuring some of the longer stories we wouldn't normally have time to get to on tonight's edition of the program because, well, you know, I like to feature these stories when we can. And it just seems that we too seldom have any time to actually share these sorts of stories. And by the way, during the next hour, we will be talking with Kenneth Thomas about UFOs, JFK conspiracies, and a host of other things. I can guarantee you it'll be an interesting conversation. I've never spoken with Kenneth before, so I'm looking forward to that when we return here on the Graylian Report. Are you an author or maybe someone who wants to write books for a living? You know, self-publishing is one of the most exciting areas in the publishing world today. The reach of the internet has made the world, well, a little smaller, and just about anyone can pursue their dreams of writing and selling their work to a readership worldwide. But when you finish writing your book, part of what sells your words is having a great-looking cover. And that's why I highly recommend Green Alien Art, featuring the work of Rick Green, one of the finest graphic artists out there, who specializes in book covers, trailers, and graphic art that will help bring your written work to life. If you're considering self-publishing, make sure your work looks the best that it can. Green Alien Art will help you do it. Online at greenalienart.com. If there's one thing that's for certain, it's that you won't be able to count on Chris Hayes and Matt Oakley behaving Tuesday nights in a bunker hundreds of miles beneath terra firma. I can attest to the fact that these guys are rapscallions.
That's absolutely not true. You've got 2-1. And really, how can you quantify good behavior? You can't really definitively...
What's he even talking about?
...say what good behavior is, because it's all relative. You just can't do it, all right? You can't.
I think I figured
it out.
You
can't do it.
Chris is intoxicated, because that's why he's not making any sense tonight.
I'm absolutely not intoxicated.
Get the guy some whole milk or something, Matt. Seriously. Yeah. I can't call you the milkman if you don't like drinking milk.
No, I love drinking milk, but after that big meal we had, a glass of whole milk would only serve to make me not feel well for the rest of the show.
The last time we have Holly serve him breakfast for dinner on this program. But I tell you what, before we get to dessert, I do want to finish this story. One of our listeners, Jerry, sends along. And we just finished up in the last segment hearing about a strange, well, maybe a ghostly apparition of a child that appeared in his home. But he says that's not the only thing that actually happened in this house. He said, my wife would often awaken from her sleep thrashing around and swatting at the air at what she perceived as maybe large spiders lowering themselves from webs fastened to the ceiling. I would hear her yelp and scream and call out at these spiders as she swatted at them or to try and catch them in the bed covering like a fisherman with a net. Well, eventually she would come around, and usually by that time I was awake or responding to her calls by running into our bedroom, where I would still describe what she saw prior to her snapping out of these hallucinations. These spider attacks occurred very frequently, so when one morning I was awakened by her yelling, "There they are, right there," I wasn't that surprised. I could only think to myself, "Oh, here we go again, more spiders, oh well." But this time, it was different. I opened my eyes to see my wife pointing frantically to the corner of the room next to the window. "There, can't you see?" she demanded. I looked toward the corner, and it occurred to me that something quite different to my wife's hallucinations, or what I perceived as such, was indeed going on. I, too, could see what she was obviously referring to as they. I could make out a strongly defined outline of three people standing at the foot of our bed. It was a specter of an approximately 6-foot-tall human-shaped figure, flanked on either side by smaller 4-foot or so humanoids. There was a thick gray-black outline around their conjoined silhouette, and inside of the outline was a shimmering, almost starfield-like mass of light, similar like to the kind of effect that you might see in Star Trek episodes when people used to be transported or beamed up into these little masses of light particles. So these figures were just standing there. I suppose that they were looking at us, studying us, but there was no way to tell, as there were no features, just the shimmering panel within the silhouette that was present there. It was at this time I realized that all I could do was look. My whole body was paralyzed. I am, and was aware of sleep paralysis and had to put down to just having woken up in that instance. But then the fear started to set in. I had to move, I thought. I had to be able to protect us, but what could I do? My wife was just sitting up pointing and yelling, but why couldn't I? And with all my might, I began to try and shout at the images, a very primal response, I suppose. It was very difficult, but I kept pushing until I let out some sort of a noise. And once I let out this noise, best described as a scream of a frightened schoolgirl, probably, I was free of my bonds, and at that very moment, the image disappeared. My encounter with the little boy in the house could be explained by me maybe still being in a dream state or having some other kind of a hallucination, but this time I know it was a shared experience. My wife and I both described to each other exactly the same apparition afterward, the same detail of the taller humanoid flanked by two smaller ones with exactly the same details. Now, years later, thanks to podcasts such as The Greylian Report and Mysterious Universe, the term shadow people has been introduced to explain shadowy visitors who appear as easily as they disappear. I've slotted our experience into that genre as well. We're both now very sure that there are unexplained things out there that interact with humans. So writes Jerry. Jerry, fantastic story, and thanks for sharing that. It reminds me of something another of our listeners, Daniel, wrote and told me about long ago. This story was so good that I wanted to contact him again and talk about it, and we've been so busy promoting things like Paradigm Symposium that I just haven't had time to really get back with him and talk at length. But he described a similar experience where not only was there a larger entity accompanied by two, well, what you might call little helpers, but he said that the larger entity actually crawled up onto him and whispered in his ear as it was holding him down on the bed that praying won't help you now. Funny thing is, as Daniel told me, you know, I consider myself an atheist, but this thing nonetheless said what it said, and I heard it very clearly. As I woke from what I thought maybe was sleep paralysis, fully awake and moving around in the room, I saw a large orb of light outside my window and passed out immediately. So what happened during such strange encounters as these? Who knows? Micah Hanks of the Greylian Report here. Today I want to talk to you about Intrepid Magazine, the new leader in clear and reasoned thinking in an unpredictable world, and the official magazine of the Greylian Report. Intrepid features the latest in-depth analysis of science, culture, conspiracy, politics, and unexplained phenomena. You'll get expert commentary from an incredible cast of seasoned writers and researchers, as well as interviews and insights from some of the biggest names in the field. And best of all, you can subscribe today for just $14.95. It's Intrepid Magazine. Boldly going. Subscribe today by visiting IntrepidMag.com, and coming soon, look for Intrepid on Nook and Kindle e-readers.
On the battlefield, there's a saying America's military men and women live by: never leave a fallen warrior behind, ever. Off the battlefield, Wounded Warrior Project operates with the same goal. Wounded Warrior Project was created to help our men and women returning home with the scars of war, whether those scars are physical or mental. Wounded Warrior Project: we never leave a fallen warrior behind, ever. Learn more about what we do at WoundedWarriorProject.org.
Exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Greylian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
Broadcasting live from the dark disquiet known as the Mohorovic discontinuity in those haunted hills of Appalachia, this is none other than the Greylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks, your host, who you meet every week here Tuesday nights, or if you download the subsequent podcast, which is issued on a weekly basis. You know, next week our regularly dispatched podcast may be not interrupted, but Well, released at a slightly inopportune, I don't know about inopportune time. It just won't be probably the regular time. I'm going to be making my way out onto the east end of the state of North Carolina, along with a friend of mine, psychic researcher Susan Davidson, and a couple of other cohorts. Should be a good time, no doubt. Of course, we'll be searching for oddities, the kinds of things that you like to hear about on this program. And thereby, I think we're probably going to be having to pre-record next week's edition of the Gray Alien Report, which will be issued a little earlier than usual. But again, that's probably actually, if anything, kind of a treat for some folks. You get your weekly dose a little sooner than usual. That should be good. And, of course, we've also got a wonderful series of guests lined up. You know, we're going to be having later this month on the program a good friend of mine and a guy who listeners of this program no doubt are well aware of, none other than Jim Harold, who is the host of the Paranormal Podcast. You know, Jim has been doing that podcast for years and years now, and I'm certain that it's going to be a great time having him on the program. I always enjoy talking with Jim, and I think that last time Jim and I actually spoke, I was a guest on his program. So we're going to have Mr. Harold on this program as our guest toward the end of August. But speaking of guests, tonight we are joined by a particularly special guest, another gentleman whom I've wanted to speak with for quite some time now. Ken Thomas is a conspiracy theorist, a writer. He's a university library archivist and editor and publisher of the Steam Shovel Press, a parapolitical conspiracy magazine. He's written books on the Inslaw affair, co-authoring The Octopus, Secret Government, and the Death of Danny Casolaro with the late Jim Keith. And he's, of course, written on Fred Chrisman and the Maury Island incident. He's probably best known right now for some of his research into JFK and the associations between the JFK assassination and UFOs. And therefore, it's with great interest that we bring to the program this evening Mr. Ken Thomas. Ken, how are you?
Mike, at last we meet.
Yes, at last we meet, and it's fantastic to speak with you, Ken. You know, I've heard for years and years that there was a memo released that stated, and I'm going to get right into things with this first question. There was I've heard that there was a memo that stated that there was a gentleman, maybe even a Secret Service agent on Air Force One with Kennedy, who had heard Kennedy remark about, if we really knew what was going on with the UFO enigma, it would really be more dire than most Americans could handle. Something along those lines. I'm paraphrasing. Now, you probably could attest to this in favor or against much better than I could. So my question to you is, what is the connection between JFK and UFOs, or is there one?
Oh, wow. So a nice little simple question to start with, huh? Well, of course there is, actually. The title of my current book is called JFK and UFO. But my research isn't really so much dependent on a Secret Service agent exposing a secret UFO program. It's actually based on research, any kind, normal kind of research that anybody would do investigating the Kennedy assassination. In fact, Jim Garrison, who investigated the Kennedy assassination in 68, was investigating this man, Fred Chrisman, mm-hmm. who he thought was the grassy knoll shooter, and who history knows as the guy who was one of the two witnesses of the Maury Island UFO in 1947. So, you know, just starting there, it followed recent history.
Well, I tell you what, let's take it back to that point, because, you know, a lot of our listeners, despite the fact that this is well publicized, they may not know about the Maury Island UFO incident. And that will give us a bit of a background about Fred Chrisman, and then maybe we can bring that back around.
That is one of the interesting things about the whole thing, is that in some circles, Maury Island is actually quite well known. And, of course, the JFK assassination is quite well known by anybody who ever grew up in this country in the last 5 decades. But very few people actually are aware of the connection. The Maury Island incident was actually the first UFO incident of the modern era. It predated Kenneth Arnold's sightings in Mount Rainier by several days. And its chief witnesses were a guy named Harold Dahl, who ran a harbor patrol boat that these group of flying saucers came down and circled over and dropped some what's been described as slag onto the boat. And his partner was this guy, Fred Chrisman, who again was subpoenaed by Jim Garrison in 1968 as the possible grassy knoll assassin in the Kennedy assassination.
Now, there's no question that they were the same guy, right?
No, no question at all. Absolutely. Of all the mysteries, that's not one of them. There are not two Fred Crismans like there are like two right. Lee Harvey Oswalds, you know.
Well, so Fred Crisman, again, was there present at this Maury Island UFO incident. And as I understand it, at the time, Ziff Davis publisher...
Ray Palmer,
that's right. Ray Palmer, who actually put out Fate magazine. Now, I understand that he actually paid for none other than Kenneth Arnold to go and look into this Maury Island UFO incident. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct, yeah. Right. Well, like I said, Kenneth Arnold's sightings happened shortly after the Maury Island case, but then he was hired by Ray Palmer to come and investigate this other case that happened before he was there. And I should clarify, too, that Harold Dahl saw a group of saucers, one of which was wobbling and spewing out this substance that hit his boat. He brought the boat to shore, and then he reported what he saw to his boss, the guy he considered his boss, and that's Crisman. Crisman went out to Puget Sound there, to Maury Island, the next day, and had another sighting himself.
You know what's interesting about that is that if this is the first UFO sighting, then effectively the first ufologist, Kenneth Arnold, was of course hired to go out there and look into this case. Now, of course, there is this mention of there being metal slag recovered at the location. What happened to the substance that was recovered by Kenneth Arnold?
Well, it was photographed, and it's discussed in Kenneth Arnold's book, The Coming of the Saucers. Anyway, yeah, this slag actually had an even more curious history after that. After Kenneth Arnold basically gave up, he got the stories from Crisman and Dahl, and he did what he could to investigate things. He didn't quite know what to do. He called in two Air Force investigators, a guy named Davidson and another guy named Brown. They collected the slag. They put it on the plane that they were traveling on. They were going to take it back to Wright-Patterson, and that plane crashed, and that's where we lose the historic trail of the slag. However, the crash site is still there, and in fact, I have an editorial on something called Silver Screen Saucers, a mm-hmm. website,
yeah,
in which I try to point out to everybody in Kelso, Washington, the crash site is still there. The slag disappeared, according to other investigators afterward, but apparently remnants of the plane, who knows, remnants of the slag may still be there. Huh. But because of the fact there's just so little awareness of how important that is and how connected it is to the most important assassination in the history of American politics, really nothing has been done about it. Bob Burns went out there, and I think he encountered a roadblock because it's private property and they wouldn't let him go on it. But if anybody really wants to know about that in detail, go to Silver Screen Saucers and see my editorial about Kelso, Washington.
I have to say, Silver Screen Saucers is one of our favorite websites, that one, and also Who Forded. We reference a lot on this program. Fantastic sites.
Robbie Grahams does a marvelous job at Silver Screen Saucers. He's just an incredible guy.
It really, yeah, truly is a fantastic website. Recommend it to everyone. Now, as you mentioned... go ahead.
Yeah,
sorry.
So my only point is here, I mean, this is... unsettled business. I mean, it's the first UFO case, the most significant political assassination in American history. Very significant stuff, and sitting out on private land somewhere are clues to it. That, you know, nobody's demanding they get excavated or studied or in any way recovered. It's amazing to me.
I think what's most amazing about that, maybe, Ken, is that this information about such things, you know, the potential presence of metallic slag recovered from a UFO or what else, this information doesn't make its way to the public. And so people go out there looking constantly for proof and for evidence, but when there is a potential for finding it, half the time, if not more, people don't know where to begin to look.
Well, right, yeah, and also there's like a silly season curtain that's drawn around it. You know, you can't really seriously discuss conspiracies. It's a study that I call parapolitics without, you know, the UFO issue being introduced and then ridiculed. Oh, you're just a UFO nut. And thereby short-circuiting any serious discussion of UFOs and of assassinations.
Right.
It's, you know, call me paranoid, but it almost seems deliberate that that's the case.
Well, we've all heard before, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean that they're not after you. That one seems to apply well. But, you know, I would say that you're not paranoid, because you already answered my previous question. Fred Crisman, who was at the Maury Island UFO incident, or who was associated with that, and then later investigated with regard to the potential assassination, or his potential involvement in the assassination of U.S. President John F. Kennedy, that cannot be disputed. So let's jump ahead to the early 1960s, there at the Dallas Motorcade, the JFK assassination. Some of the key players in the history of American ufology were present, and how?
Present at the assassination?
Where they were present and involved in the circumstances, namely Crisman. So how does this story unfold here involving Crisman?
How does it unfold involving Crisman and the assassination? Well, basically, when Jim Garrison started his investigation in New Orleans in 1968, he got a letter, an anonymous letter, that said that Crisman was Crisman was the assassin, and that his associations included this guy Clay Shaw, who was eventually the figure that Garrison eventually prosecuted. This is all kind of mapped out pretty clearly in the Oliver Stone movie. You've ever seen JFK by Oliver Stone?
Oh yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah. The point was that Clay Shaw, the man who was prosecuted, was the only person that Garrison could get enough on to actually take to court. And early on in his investigation, he got information from informants that one of Clay Shaw's associates was this guy, Fred Crisman. So that's where it all began.
Wow.
Clay Shaw supposedly was responsible for the surrender of Wernher von Braun, for the American side of the surrender, Wernher von Braun and Walter Dornberger and all the paperclip Nazi scientists.
Uh-huh.
So the link, to German rocket science and all that weirdness is right there with Clay Shaw, too.
Well, that's interesting also. Now, of course, Herbert Walker Bush was allegedly there present that day. Maybe I'm playing 7 degrees of saucers here, but as I understand it, George Herbert Walker Bush, of course, also later denied information about flying saucers to President, I almost said John F. Kennedy, I'm sorry, it was President, who was it here, Chris? Help me out here, Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter was denied access, right?
Yeah, the UFO guy.
So I guess you could actually say that George Herbert Walker Bush, who was apparently at the motorcade that day as well, was also involved, right?
Well, yeah, you know, you're right. It's a game, kind of a parlor game that people who get into the study of the Kennedy assassination do a lot, you know, the 90 degrees of separation. In fact, the recent mass murders in Aurora, Colorado, even has a Kennedy assassination link. In fact, I was the one who discovered it. There was an episode of What's My Line, the old game show, mm-hmm. that featured the first woman mayor of Aurora, Colorado. The same show was the last appearance of Dorothy Kilgallen, who died under mysterious circumstances. She had arrived on the show just after interviewing Jack Ruby. So there's your JFK link to the Aurora killing.
That's interesting. Why do you think those sorts of parallels tend to pop up? I hear people referring to it nowadays as synchromysticism or just synchronicity in general. What is it about the symbology that seems tucked away in these sorts of things that cause these sorts of parallels to pop up? Or do you have a theory about it? Is it just so weird that there is no theory?
Well, you know, the idea of synchronicity, of course, that comes from Carl Jung. And Jung's notion of synchronicity is actually based on the work of a guy named Paul Kammerer. He called it seriality. And what it actually means, it's kind of hard to really discuss it in linear terms, because what we're talking about are acausal relationships, relationships that exist but don't necessarily cause one thing or another. And since we're so used to talking in terms of cause and effect, it's kind of hard to wrap our minds around it. But it's certainly eerie, and it certainly yields a great deal of information. I recently discovered watching old episodes of, I don't remember, a television show called Route 66.
Vaguely, yes.
Remember that one?
Vaguely, yeah. I'm sure our listeners probably
remember.
Well,
there was an episode of Route 66 that begins at the Fort Worth Airport and continues with the two guys, the Route 66, who basically are Kerouac and Cassidy. But these two guys, they get a job at the Trade Mart. And in the course of all this, they brush up against Earl Cabal, who was the mayor of Dallas, whose brother Charles Cabal was fired by JFK from his position as an assistant executive director of the CIA because of his involvement with Bay of Pigs. So there's all these connections in this Route 66 episode through this kind of acausal synchronistic approach that are just remarkable to the Kennedy assassination. And yet, the episode was broadcast in 1962, a full year before it even happened.
Isn't that strange? It's funny how that seems to happen. You know, and I've noticed similar circumstances in the fiction of H.P. Lovecraft and even of Edgar Allan Poe going further back. Stories that were meant to be fiction that later showed to, prove to have very, very stark parallels to real-life events that were going to happen.
I'll tell you, another person in history who had a kind of a strange obsession with this all, too, mm-hmm. was Kenneth Arnold.
Ah, okay.
Kenneth Arnold was a great believer in synchronicity and coincidence. In fact, he gave his daughter even has a website out there. Her name is Kim Arnold, and she has this note that he gave her from November 22nd, 1973, 10 years after, and it's all the famous Kennedy-Lincoln coincidences, the coincidences between those assassinations.
Oh, there are dozens, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so, you know, it doesn't necessarily yield any new information about any of the topics, but sometimes the associations do. They do. In fact, another strange thing, another episode of Route 66, the one that was supposed to be broadcast the day Kennedy was shot but was pulled from broadcast, was about, it was called To Kill a King. And it was about a guy who was going to try to pull off a political assassination who happened to be a double of one of the main characters of the show. Just as if you know anything about the Kennedy assassination, there are several Oswald doubles doing various things in Dallas before it happens. So, and then this is 1953 when it happened, and it's like playing out on national television.
Incredible, and it was scheduled for air that very day.
That's right. I don't know if it ever really aired. I understand you can still get it in a DVD set of the box, Route 66 reruns, but. Yeah.
Just
that, and the other strange thing about it is this other program that I was mentioning from 1962, there's actually two of them. There's another one that has all these other parallels to the Kennedy assassination, starring Tuesday Weld. But there are also newspaper clippings of George Hearst's brother from the time, who was involved in the production of the thing, hanging out at Jack Ruby's club. Again, this is a year before anything happened, So these connections must mean something. But all these years of people fascinated with the Kennedy assassination, I'm only beginning to try to figure out what this is all about.
So I assume you touch on this some in the book, JFK and UFO, correct?
No. All this Route 66 stuff has just come up recently.
Oh, really? So this is since the publication of that book. My gosh, you're going to have to do a whole other book on this, Ken.
Well, actually, I'm doing my newest book. I'm trying to do a Kindle book now called Popular Parapolitics, which kind of collects the essays that I have written that haven't been any of my other books. And in the introductory remarks, I go over what I know so far about the Route 66 thing. I'm not quite sure where it's all leading. But
sometimes you don't know where you're going until you reach the end of the road, right?
Until you get there, yeah.
Well, I'll be interested in seeing where this one goes. That's for sure.
Right
now,
well, I should say another thing too. Is first off, just let me mention in passing that Fred Crisman, Jim Garrison actually went on the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, and you can probably get up on YouTube and at least get the audio of this. And he brought with him a picture of the three tramps. This is something that's known in the Kennedy assassination
mm-hmm,
lore.
Right.
There are these three tramps that are being paraded from behind the railroad yard.
Oh, yeah.
And Garrison is just about is holding up the photographs and just about ready to say, this man is Fred Crisman, we know who he is, when Johnny Carson freaks out and shuts him down. So Crisman's name doesn't get mentioned on the air, but just falls that short of it.
Now, that actually
went
to air. The
other thing I can say about that is that of the official arrest records of those three tramps, there's one guy named Harold Doyle, uh-huh. which if you speak with a Texas accent, you could be saying Harold Dahl, who was the other Maury Island eyewitness.
How bizarre. Now, I know that there's a stark similarity between one of the tramps and E. Howard Hunt, but boy, I hadn't heard Harold Dahl or, of course, our friend Mr. Crisman. Now, that actually went to air with Johnny Carson freaking out and not allowing him to say that.
That's right, yeah. Garrison had the photographs, and he felt that he had enough on on Chrisman that he could say it on the air, but Johnny Carson didn't. You know, Johnny Carson was skeptical, just like everybody's skeptical of anybody talking about the Kennedy assassination.
Yeah, sure.
Even though, I mean, if you look at the history of the Kennedy assassination, the Warren Commission did conclude that it was a lone nut, but the House Committee on Assassinations in the 70s concluded that there was a conspiracy. So if anybody's got like a schizophrenic view about what the Kennedy assassination is all about, it's the government.
Absolutely, absolutely. And there was plenty of information that was omitted by the Warren Commission in their investigation and, you know.
That's right. And all of the connections, what's really buried mostly in, that I try to bring out in JFK and UFO, are all the connections to our own advanced aircraft program. Lee Harvey Oswald was some kind of spy connected to the U-2 program. He served in Atsugi, Japan, in the Marines where the U-2s flew out of. When he defected to the Soviet Union, he was able to give the Soviets the information they needed to shoot down Gary Power's U-2. The job that he had before the book depository was with this firm, Charles Stovall, that processed U-2 film. You know, and the U-2 was this high-flying aerial reconnaissance craft. And you know, those are connections that people don't even get to in their debate between you know, was it a single nut or was it the mob or whatever. And the last speech that JFK ever gave, he was talking about the TFX tactical fighter, another high altitude reconnaissance plane that eventually became the F-111 and was sold to Australia and wound up creating the funding corridor that created Pine Gap, which was Australia's version of Area 51. The U-2, of course, flew out of Area 51.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, so there's a whole pattern of historical facts here that just, you know, bring so much more meaningful discussion to what the Kennedy assassination is about, to what ufology is about, you know, and why it's so important to our popular culture and to our understanding of what's real and what isn't.
You know, again, I come back to the mention of, you know, memos, memorandum that discussed how, for instance, Kennedy had discussed a joint space program between America and the Soviets, and he said that we need to be able to identify the knowns and the unknowns. No one's particularly certain what he was talking about. And then there was this mention of a man on the Air Force One flight who had said, yes, you know, Kennedy was very concerned about the presence of these UFOs and the complexity of what may have been going on. You know, some conspiracy-minded individuals, not to say that we aren't per se, might even assert that I think without
parapolitically oriented.
Yeah, that's a better way of putting it, isn't it? Yes. If you don't
right.
mind.
Well, let me say too that prefix para means to run alongside. So the politics of parapolitics are the things that are going on alongside the mainstream view, just like paranoia is a kind of consciousness that runs alongside normal awareness.
See, so much of this is in how we term it, and I like that. I hope you won't mind if we borrow that expression from time to time.
Oh, you're welcome to. I'm trying to get more wide usage.
we'll certainly have to do that then. You know, Ken, I tell you, you know, we're going to be out of time here in just a couple of minutes. I want to try and touch on all the bases. Obviously, there is some sort of connection between whatever we call modern ufology, the Kennedy assassination. Some might even, you know, associate the actual killing of President Kennedy with a lot of these sorts of secret projects and things, whether having to do with advanced aviation and the like that were going on.
Well, let me interject just one point. Is that
sure.
Garrison felt that Fred Chrisman was working for Boeing.
Well, there you go.
He believed that Fred Chrisman was an assassin and an employee of the aerospace industry called Boeing. Anyway,
see, there are a lot of tie-ins to aerospace and to aviation, and I don't think that can be ignored. It's fascinating to me, though, because these are lesser known. You know, people look at the obvious things that were going on in politics and in America at the time, and if you try and bring up these other potentials, again, you are a conspiracy theorist. It's almost a dirty word if someone, you know, if you're called a conspiracy theorist. Do you take certain pride in being called that? I know that the New Yorker magazine called your work on the cutting edge of conspiracy, and they actually said, what was it here? They said, according to this New Yorker article, your name has become a proverb for a conspiracy theorist, and enough so that baseball was described in print as involving a fishy behavior to keep Ken Thomas swarming for years.
That's right. That was in a baseball almanac. That's my baseball statistic.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So, my son is so proud of that.
Well, I would be too, and that's what I'm asking you is, do you like being called a conspiracy theorist, or are you like a lot of people, and do you think that really conspiracy is only equated with nut jobs and people who believe bold theories with nothing to support them?
Well, it's like I said. It's I believe that it's a legitimate area of study, and it's called parapolitics. And there are many honored scholars, like Mae Brussel, for instance, who was one of the founders of this kind of conspiracy thought. Peter Dale Scott, who coined the term parapolitics. John Judge, who runs the coalition on political assassinations out of D.C. It's a kind of a culture that runs alongside whatever gets discussed on the evening news or whatever people want to pretend is the mainstream dumb show of left and right. And it's a community, you know, of legitimate, thoughtful people. And, you know, sure, there are a lot of people out there that just want to look at you and make fun of you and call you a conspiracy theorist, but those are just people who look at other people and make fun of them. They're not people who think or who apply, you know, historical knowledge to the current situation. They're not even worth listening to. And it's a job for anybody who thinks they are labeled a conspiracy theorist. You know, I do think it's, I do not proudly go up to people and say, hi, I'm a conspiracy theorist.
Right.
But I do say that, you know, what I write about is something of legitimate concern. It's also much more meaningful way of discussing what's actually going on instead of the kind of stupid crap they give you on television.
Yeah.
You know, and I think, you know, and if you get people discussing this on a one-on-one basis, you know, it's just like any other prejudice, you know. People, you know, they're the racist out there. If you know, actually get to talking to somebody of the race they don't like, you know, they can get friendly toward them, you know. And once you get down to brass tacks, serious details like we've been discussing here now, people get it and people like it, and they can push the discussion forward.
Absolutely.
So I'm happy to facilitate that.
Well, we're very glad that you do it as well. We need people like you out there who are doing this. And I'll say this also. We have a lot of listeners in the Atlanta area here in the American South. I understand at the end of the month you're going to be at the Dragon Con, correct?
Well, yeah, so my plans, tentative as they are, I have not been invited there to speak or anything like that, but one of my fellow conspiracy type writers, a guy named Adam Gorightly, is giving a talk on something called the Principia Discordia, mm-hmm. which is like the founding document of this offshoot religion called Discordianism, which kind of worships the Greek god Eros, the goddess of chaos. And this is all wrapped up. A writer named Robert Anton Wilson, who wrote the Illuminatus trilogy, was very much into this. And I was a friend of Wilson's, and Wilson and I were both friends of Tim Leary. And so I really want to be there, and I want to go there and say some words. I haven't been invited to do that, but yeah, I think I'm going to try to go down there and crash it and have some kind of presence at Dragon Con.
Well, it sounds like my staff and I are going to have to crash the Dragon Con as well. So, Ken, if it all comes together, maybe we'll be down there, especially Chris Hayes, my producer. I know he's a huge fan and wants to be there. Ken?
Well, that would be great. I'd love to meet you, Mike.
Yeah.
I'd love to come back on your show sometime.
Well, you know, we'll certainly have to have you back on the show sometime. And, of course, before we let you go today, if we do happen to see you at the Dragon Con, we make it down there, you and I, I'm sure, will have plenty more to talk about. But for the time being, can you tell our listeners how they can find out more about you and your work?
Okay, well, you know, my website is called steamshovelpress.com. And if you go there, you'll find the latest editorial work. And at the top of it, it'll have my Gmail account, so you can write to me there. Or on Facebook, you can find me under Steam Shovel Press.
Excellent. That's how you find him. Ken Thomas, ladies and gentlemen. Of course, his new book is JFK and UFO, but there will be another one coming out after that, as I understand, since all these parallels keep piling together. Ken, we hope you'll join us again soon on the Grailian Report, okay?
Thank you, Mike. I had a great time. I'll have to talk to you again soon.
Thank you very much. And, of course, best of luck with your ongoing research into these strange associations, the parapolitical aspects of our existence. When we come back, ladies and gentlemen, we will be delving into, well, something weird that might have been going on during the opening ceremony of the Olympics. Did you catch that? It was quite a performance. You know, there have been all these associations being made in the political mainstream about you know, the political meanings behind the symbolism in that event. But maybe there was something else going on. Or maybe not. We'll delve into that when we come back here on the Grailian Report. I'm Micah Hanks.
Fearless, adventurous, bold, and daring. These words all combine to define intrepid, both as an expression within the English lexicon and when describing Intrepid Magazine, the new leader in clear and reasoned thinking. Intrepid Magazine features in-depth analysis of the latest science, culture, conspiracy, politics, and unexplained phenomena, like UFOs and the paranormal. Subscribe to Intrepid for 1 year and receive 12 issues, all for just $14.95. Intrepid Magazine. Boldly going. To learn more, visit intrepidmag.com.
It is where conspiracy theory becomes conspiracy fact. Welcome back to the Gray Alien Report. I'm Micah Hanks, along with co-host and producer Chris the Milkman Hayes and Matt the Reverend Oakley. Matt seems so sad tonight. Matt,
not sad.
Cheer up, guy.
Just trying to get a crack at my liquor here.
Are you playing that? Are you playing that unicorn game? The one where the unicorn farts rainbows.
I'll leave that one up to Chris.
Chris, what's the game called?
It's called Robot Unicorn Attack. The version I play is Robot Unicorn Attack Evolution.
We were laughing so hard
because not only do you play as a unicorn that's a robot that farts rainbows, you can also turn into a gorilla, a wolf, a saber-toothed tiger, a panda, and a dragon that also fart rainbows.
Why? Oh God!
Why not?
Why not?
That's the next step in evolution. I feel
it's really the only game I can play while still pretending to pay attention to you.
the only game authorized for in studio use during Gray Alien Report broadcast. Well, that's always good. You know, after talking with Ken Thomas, who has a very interesting, almost synchromystical kind of take on the study of conspiracies, very interesting stuff, I had to point out, I was talking with one of the producers of Conspiracy Theory on the telephone yesterday afternoon. We've been playing phone tag again as usual. And I was looking at the True TV website, okay, earlier today, and there's this story that Liz Lenz, one of their bloggers there at the site, has posted, titled Secret Shadow Government Really Exists. In a move of surprising pointlessness, she says, Randy Shannon, the Republican candidate for a state Senate seat in eastern Iowa, has dropped out to instead be appointed a senator in a shadowy organization called the Republic for the United States of America. Now, I read that sentence and I thought, what? Because, sure enough, I was familiar with this organization. In fact, I was having a business meeting via Skype with Scotty Roberts about Paradigm Symposium, with a friend who is one of our radio affiliates up in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And this gentleman had asked Scotty during this meeting, are you familiar with the Republic of the United States of America? And Scotty asked me, have you heard about these guys? Sent me a link through the Skype window, and I looked at it. Well, the Des Moines Register reports dropping her bid for state office was a rejection of that illegitimate government. Okay. Now she says that she has been appointed to serve apparently the illegitimate government she was talking about, by the way, was the American government. Randy Shannon says that now she has said that she's been appointed to serve as a U.S. Senator in the recently revived and constitutionally legitimate Republic of the United States of America. Note that they spell it. I noticed, by the way, that Liz Lenz here, the blogger, did not use the proper lower capitalization of the word United, but it's probably a small point. But I do want to point out that this organization does not capitalize the U in United, okay? Everything else, Republic, States, and America, are all capitalized. United is not. Well, in a letter dated July 4th, imagine that, Shannon wrote, the legitimate federal government of the United States was replaced by illegitimate corporate government in 1871, and has been operating since then in violation of the U.S. Constitution. She also noted that she's taken a long time to reach this decision, which seems fair. Crazy like this doesn't just happen overnight, says the blogger, by the way. The website for the Republic of the United States of America encourages citizens to join the shadow government, challenging them to throw off their U.S. citizenship by arguing that you can't be both a member of the Republic and a U.S. citizen because you can't be a slave and a free man at the same time. However, upon further investigation, it seems that joining and throwing off the yoke of your citizenship merely requires, well, signing up for their newsletter and making a donation. Which means next year, Shannon's letter to the IRS is going to look something like, "Dear IRS, I don't have to pay my taxes because I signed up for this here newsletter." But regardless, I thought it was pretty interesting that this story came up, and that the reference, at least by one blogger, has been that this Republic of the United States of America could be likened to the existence of a real shadow government. What I wonder is whether it's referred to as the shadow government on their own website. And I haven't had time to look, but we'll have that linked to the show notes tonight. Certainly a very interesting story, and in keeping with this kind of conspiracy theme that we've been talking about tonight. But as I'd mentioned earlier, and I want to get around to this, hopefully you watched the opening ceremonies of the Olympics. Matt, you missed them. Chris, did you happen to see them?
I did not know. It was... I believe it was Matt's birthday.
It was Matt's birthday.
That's
this was,
right.
Yes,
we
right.
Were,
so we were not in front of a television.
The engineer was celebrating, lounging around on somebody's couch, basking in the moonlight like a Hadal.
That's right.
And, yeah. But
I mean, I wouldn't have used those words personally.
Basking
but
like a Hadal. Basking like a basking shark, maybe.
To that effect.
Basking like a half-rotted basking shark, maybe. Well, anyway. I managed to get back over to headquarters because I don't keep a television in my house. I really don't. I had to get back over to headquarters just so that I could watch. And I didn't really. I'll just be honest with you. I know a lot of people probably would be offended. I don't want to offend anyone, but people would be offended by this statement. But I'm not that interested in the Olympics, frankly. Okay, I know the tradition and of course the spirit of competition. The political undertones, and sometimes overtones as well, that are associated with the Olympic Games and these sorts of things. The historical significance, of course. The geoeconomic aspects associated with it. All very interesting, but frankly, when it comes to just watching the actual competitions and the sports, this is just my opinion, so take it for what it is, but I'm just not that interested in sitting around and watching, you know, these. I used to be, when I was a kid, I used to love to watch, you know, the different sports and the competitions and things, but today, I've got a lot of other things that my attention is typically occupied by. But the opening ceremonies, of course, you know, I thought would be interesting. And so I managed to catch that. And I was watching. And I was, you know, I tell you, it was an incredibly well-orchestrated and coordinated event. I understand, I believe director Danny Boyle was associated with this. And, of course, you know, they had this incredible array where the five rings come together. And you can see it's kind of a tribute to the Industrial Revolution there in London. And all these people out there swinging hammers and doing all this. It was really incredibly well done. And there was this very, you know, almost ethereal sounding dramatic music swelling up from behind. And this, you know, I have to say a sense of pride and, of course, nationalism even, you know, is coming forth. These people, you know, displaying what is meaningful to them in their history, the Londoners. We've got a lot of listeners in London and the UK, and I'm sure that they probably, maybe some of them were there. In fact, if you were actually there, maybe you saw this firsthand and could share your own feelings about this. And if not, if you're in London, it might also just be interesting to hear what your thoughts are about the Olympics in general taking place in your hometown. We'd love to hear from you. info@graylianreport.com from any of our English listeners. And I know there are a few of them that email me quite frequently. But that said, it was a very, very even moving display. But get this. Prior to the actual ceremony, there had been bets being placed, okay, officially, that a UFO was going to show up during the opening ceremony. There were bets going. There had been several bets placed with regard to a UFO potentially showing up. And I know that Nick Pope, who is you know, always cited by the press, you know, the Huffington Post and a lot of these news sources, the Sun and the Daily Register, I believe, over in the UK, they love to quote Nick Pope, former Ministry of Defense official who studied UFOs in an official capacity. And, you know, we've actually featured Nick Pope on this program in the past as well as a guest. Great guy. Like Nick a lot. But Nick Pope had also said that there were bets running, and I think he'd said something along the lines of, you know, what better circumstances for a UFO to appear if it was indeed something to denote the presence of extraterrestrials than what better than the Olympics, you know. So there had been a lot of talk about whether a UFO would touch down or make its presence known during the Olympics. And sure enough, reviewing footage where if you didn't get to watch this as it was occurring live, it's all over the internet now. But you can see as these five rings, the Olympic rings, are coming together in the sky in this great big performance. Sure enough, there's some object, some large silvery object off in the distance moving very slowly through the sky, but very clearly. Not a photographic anomaly, nothing quite like that. The Huffington Post actually carried the story this week. They say, talk about an uninvited guest at the Olympics. Friday night's spectacular pyrotechnics display of the most watched opening ceremony in Summer Olympics history. It attracted more than just the eyes of over 40 million people. A clearly seen, unidentified flying object, clearly seen but unidentified nonetheless, was videotaped making its way over London's Olympic Stadium, according to Examiner.com. The disc-shaped object is first seen entering the upper left portion of the video, which they have linked, and we'll have that link to our blog, as the fireworks erupt over the stadium. The UFO, which appears to have a dome or a bulge rising from its center, and indeed in the photographs that they link here, it does look very saucer-shaped. It moves slowly across the skies, if deliberately observing the light show spectacle below it. While NBC Olympics, a division of NBC Sports, has chosen Goodyear blimps for all of its 2012 Olympics aerial coverage, the strange-looking object that appeared over the opening ceremonies doesn't appear to be a blimp. So what is it? Well, I'll tell you exactly what it was. It was a blimp. I'm serious. In fact, according to a statement released by Goodyear, whom we know already had blimps in the air during the entirety of the Olympic opening ceremony, Goodyear spokespeople said that the UFO in the videos was definitely our blimp. But the Goodyear blimp, I mean, you can see on the side illuminated the words Goodyear, right? They've got a great big electrical sign that's actually hooked up. This object, you clearly don't see Goodyear on the side, so that thing couldn't have been the Goodyear blimp, right? Well, get this. To put it simply, the electric signage had been turned off so that it wouldn't interfere with the show. Goodyear U.S. Public Relations Manager Doug Grassian said, I can definitely tell you, we were up in the air for the entirety of the opening ceremonies. I can't speak to what else might have been in the air, but the blimp was certainly up there during those fireworks. During the whole ceremony, he says, we were providing coverage for NBC, so we were up there in the air the whole time. And sure enough, when we look at photographs of what the Goodyear blimp looked like without the Goodyear emblem lit up, it's very clear what it is when it's got the great big Goodyear lettering emblazoned across its side. With those lights turned off, well, it does look kind of like a great big saucer with a big empty blue streak right through the center. But get this, and this is where it gets interesting. Because I think that this comes down, in a sense, to a case of which came first, the chicken or the egg. 3 days prior to the start of the Olympics, the Associated Press had reported that William Hill, a London betting house, had offered 1,000-to-1 odds that a flying saucer would appear over Olympic Stadium during the opening ceremony. So people in the UK had been wondering. This had already appeared in the Associated Press. And they were even betting on whether or not a flying saucer might appear. Isn't that interesting? And I wonder what it is about big events like this that people always think... I mean, I know it's obvious that, okay, huge event, lots of people watching, aliens are going to announce their presence. But it doesn't seem to me that... While I don't think that some of these UFOs and various UFO reports are overly... They don't appear to operate in a manner that is indicative that the operators are overtly concerned with being seen. By the same token, they don't seem to really announce their presence. They don't seem to be really concerned with people seeing them. They don't really seem to care one way or another. If they're seen, well, not a big deal, but they're not overly concerned with whether or not they get spotted. But I don't think it's been the case, at least for the last, well, since 1947, that UFOs appear to want to be seen. Now, despite the fact that we broadcast from a bunker hundreds of miles beneath the Earth's surface, I'll tell you, it is storming so badly above the bunker tonight that people may even be able to hear the walls shaking.
Well, I think that may be an earthquake, actually.
That's what I'm saying. The walls are shaking. I doubt they'll even be able to hear that, but I can feel that little shuddering. And even sometimes this far down, when it's storming badly enough. Boy, I'll tell you what, Asheville must be underwater right now. Another reason I'm glad I'm broadcasting from a bunker. You know, a friend was talking to me recently and said, you know, I wonder what it would be like to live in a cave. And I said, well, come on down. We can redecorate Studio C. I think it'd be a wonderful setup. You might really enjoy it. And Studio C, of course, served famously when we were holed up down here, protecting ourselves from the onslaught of the Imperial Hadal forces as they were attacking us. Oh, goodness. I think this is fun to talk about, by the way. Hadal's attacking and the like. And to be honest with you, nonetheless, it seems that for some reason some people get angry when I talk about that. Don't talk about silly stuff on your show, Micah Hanks. Stay serious. Always.
Well, you know what? To all those people who think talking about Hadal's is silly stuff, I cordially invite every last one of you down in to the Moho to experience how silly the Hadals and any associated Hadal uprisings are.
Don't tell the Hadals you think they're silly.
No, no, I don't think they're silly at all. I'm married to the High Priestess, all right?
Doesn't that amount to, since we've been talking about all this, you know, Republic and Democracy and United States and all this stuff, conspiracies, doesn't that, in a Jeffersonian sense, come around to the idea of entangling alliances, Chris?
Well, not really, because I don't represent the human government whatsoever.
Boy, that's what scares me. So you're one of them. I thought you were my friend, but you're one of them.
No, I'm what? I'm
yeah.
How can I
all
entangle,
right,
like, okay. Like, easy. I mean, really, I just... It's you're judging me because I'm in love.
Nobody's judging you.
You know what? It's cosmic.
I'm judging you.
Cosmic.
It is cosmic.
Cosmic what?
Cosmic love.
Cosmic love, baby. You've got the love. Oh, well, I'm happy to hear that for you, Chris. I'm glad that you finally... I'm glad that it found its way to you. I knew it would eventually. Even the undead, well, can... Well, you know, they say that you can't unlove, but I think that the undead can find their way to love, nonetheless. So that's good to hear. So needless to say, this thing over the Olympic ceremony was, well, not a UFO. But it's interesting that a lot of people nonetheless wanted to believe that it was. And in the video, I have to say that they have linked. Again, we'll have that linked up at the blog. In the video that you look at, you will clearly be able to see that this thing looks like a UFO. Okay. But, again, it's because whereas with people expecting to see the Goodyear blimp, expect to see that sign, and when they don't see the sign, they're like, well, it looks kind of like a blimp, but the Goodyear blimp should look like this, and that does not, so what am I seeing? Could it be something else? And it kind of got me thinking. You know, I talked about this drone that I saw last week, and, you know, really, the skeptic in me is coming out now, second-guessing the circumstances, despite the fact that the thing was moving so slowly through the sky, appeared only as a bright light for the first, you know, probably 2 minutes that I observed it, and despite the fact that I was moving, it appeared to be hovering in the sky before I saw colored lights, and then it started to trail away over the tree line in the distance at a very slow rate of speed. I still feel that, you know, there's a stark potential that it could have been an aircraft, you know, some sort of conventional aircraft, maybe not a commercial airplane, but just something that... just under the circumstances looked a bit off, and off enough for me to question it. You know, I just don't know. But then the next night, of course, Caleb Hanks and Dakota Waddell, one of our field correspondents, had actually been outdoors viewing a movie on Brevard Road near where I had seen this object the night before, and claimed that they saw what they described as, quote, a triangle-shaped object with colored lights that appeared to be not necessarily underneath the object, but around the exterior of the triangle, and that this thing moved rather slowly over them and headed south toward the Asheville Regional Airport. And then he said that, dang, if the thing didn't come back, but when it flew overhead, that this time it looked like it was tilted at just enough of an angle where they could see these lights as though the edge of the craft had been tilted slightly toward them as it flew over. And he said, I think we just saw that drone you saw. And so I asked the local talk radio host, Matt Matan, as I mentioned earlier, you know anything about drones in the area? And he says, oh, yeah, absolutely. Hear about it, this sort of thing all the time. So, and even the cover of Wired Magazine, I believe it was last month, was all about drones. And how, get this, you know, commercial drones are available that people can actually purchase for mapping and for aerial photography and a host of different other things. So in the coming years, I think that the UFO reports are going to go on the rise without question, but largely because, I don't think it has so much to do with aliens again, but largely because there's just going to be a lot more stuff in the skies than previously had been, and I think that certainly, although there are conventional explanations behind these sorts of things, whether they be drones or whatever else, not everybody's going to look at these things and go, oh yeah, that's one of those drones I read about or saw on television. There are always going to be people who will say, what was that? What did I see? And again, in this footage of the Olympics ceremony from last week, it looks convincing. But unfortunately, it's not really anything too terribly important. So, for those of us, you know, and this is why I tend to get pretty skeptical about this. And I should probably just conclude. We're about out of time, but I should conclude by saying on the Facebook page for Paradigm Symposium, there was a gentleman who came on and he was just lambasting us. You know, he was going after Scotty, going after I, going after us, saying, "You guys are profiting off of the UFO myth." And we said, "Well, what exactly do you mean?" And he says, of course, starts talking about all this hoax and this myth associated with extraterrestrials, and starts going into his reasons for how and why aliens from other planets wouldn't be able to visit Earth. And of course, we have to respond by saying, well, who aside from yourself assumed that we were talking about anything extraterrestrial? Whatever these UFOs are, they may not be extraterrestrial. How do we prove that? Who knows? But those are over there at the Paradigm Symposium Facebook page. You can check that out. And hey, while you're on Facebook, check out the Graylian Report. You can actually like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. And of course, if you haven't visited the website already, you can also check us out online at www.graelienreport.com. And with that, my friends, it wraps up another edition of the program. Chris, I think you can go to sleep now.
Okay.
Okay. Well, on behalf of Chris Hayes, Matt Oakley, Dick Oakley, John Anderson, Holly, and yours truly, Micah Hanks, the Mouth of the South, broadcasting another week from the Moho, it is the Graylian Report. My friends, we'll talk to you next time. And until then, as always, stay strange.